remember, we're doing the calculation two different ways. We're still on the first way. In the first way, we didn't make any assumptions about what's happening with this interaction once you ping a photon. You ping a proton using a photon and produce a whole bunch of hadronic stuff. So we didn't really know very much about how to do the calculation, but we tried not to let that stop us. And it seemed like at the end of last class on Tuesday, we were basically just kind of stuck in a big mess. But we're going to actually just wrap it up, and it's not going to be as messy as it seems. So we spent a lot of time discussing different variables, different kinematic variables for parameterizing our cross section. And I just want to also remind you about that, because that will be important in what follows. Remember, if we have just two-to-two scattering, elastic scattering, we only have one independent kinematic variable, like the scattering angle, or t, in addition to the center of mass energy, which we're just assuming is fixed. But for the case of inelastic scattering, where the final state h is not just the proton, but a whole bunch of final states, we have now two kinematic variables. So I should say two that are actually independent. We really defined four different ones. Not all of them are independent. It's easier to see that some of them are related to each other. So for inelastic scattering, I'm going to think of x as being one of the independent variables. And then once you have x, you can also take one out of the following y, nu, or q squared as your other independent variable. You're free to choose. And we're going to be switching between them. In the case of elastic scattering, you can still have these as one of these as your independent variable, or t, or cosine theta, for example. But x is now fixed, is equal to 1. So you can only have one of these as independent. All right, so this one of these could be your independent variable for elastic scattering. OK, so that was the recap. We went through, we wrote down some long expressions for this cross section. But at the end of the day, we didn't know how to compute this hadronic matrix element. So we just grouped a whole bunch of terms together and lumped it all up together into a big function, which we call W. And because W included a sum over states, sum over the final hadronic states H, this function W doesn't really depend on what H is in any way. So let's see, where do we leave off? So here's what we have now. So the terms that we were left over with, we had 2EL, we had this factor of the relative velocity, we had a factor of 2 pi, we had phase space integral. We have photon coupling over the photon propagator squared. We had a 1/2 the trace of stuff from the lepton part, L prime gamma mu, L slash gamma nu. And then we had a whole bunch of other stuff that came from the hadronic matrix element, which we just lumped together into this function W. So I'll just write that W mu nu like this. So this function W represents all of the unknown hadronic physics. So we don't know how to compute it in general from first principles, because we can't solve for the strong interaction dynamics of hadronization or other aspects as well. But we can parameterize it just using Lorentz invariants. So let's also define this object here as a leptonic tensor. And W mu nu is a hadronic tensor. So we use Lorentz invariants. We're also going to use parity conservation. Parity is violated by the weak interaction, but we're not dealing with the weak interaction here. We only have the electromagnetic interaction and the strong interaction for all of the hadronic dynamics. So neither of those two forces violate parity. So we can assume that parity is conserved here. So we need to write down different objects that have indices mu and nu and ask, how can we construct such objects? So for example, we could have eta mu nu. We could have, let's ask first which momenta we have to play with. So we have momentum p going in. And we have some interaction here. And momentum q also going in. And then we have this hadronic stuff going out. So the different ways I can get Lorentz indices is just using the proton momentum p and the momentum q of the virtual photon. So I could write down something like p mu, p nu. I could have q mu, q nu, p mu, q nu, p nu, q mu. And then I can have an epsilon tensor, epsilon mu nu, alpha beta, p alpha, q beta. OK? I don't need all of them, though. It turns out that if I had these terms, they would vanish once I contract them with a leptonic tensor. This one I also don't need, because this one would be parity violating. You can see that just because the epsilon tensor would have to have one time-like component and three space-like components. That would flip sign if I did a parity transformation. OK, so only these two are allowed.
Is it easy to see why the other three would vanish when contracted?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, it's a consequence of the Ward identity. So if I had a q here, I'm basically asking what happens if momentum q gets contracted into the leptonic current. If you want to see it explicitly, you just expand this out, and you would just plug in the fact that q is the momentum transfer from the lepton side, like this. So you can see it. It's not hard to show. OK. All right, so we'll just use those two. So here is this parameterization. W mu nu is equal to, so I can have an eta mu nu term. And I can also have p mu p nu, like this. And then multiplying them, I have some arbitrary functions, which are Lorentz scalars. And by convention, those functions, the first one, it just has an overall minus sign in front. And it's denoted W1. And also by convention, the second one is denoted W2. But then it also has this factor of MP squared taken out. OK. So W1 and W2 are Lorentz scalars. And they only depend on other Lorentz scalars. OK, so the only scalar quantities I can construct from P and Q would be Q squared or P dotted into Q. P squared is just a constant proton mass. So I have two independent scalars. I don't have to use these two. I can use some of the kinematic variables that I introduced, which are equivalent. For example, x and q squared. Or a different choice. You're free to choose. But typically, by convention, people take this particular combination. OK. All right. Then I just want to introduce yet another basis of functions. So I introduced W1 and W2, but people define another set of functions as well, which are just related to W1 and W2 by a factor. And so another thing to introduce, so by convention, we can define two other functions. Which are denoted as f1e, and it's a function of x and q squared, as 2 times mpw1 x and q squared, and f2e x and q squared is nu times w2. OK, so it's a little bit silly to introduce two sets of functions which are basically equivalent. But this is what people do, so I'm just following. OK, so it's just another definition. All right, so in terms of these functions, we're going to compute the differential cross-section. And then the result is just going to depend on these functions of two independent kinematic variables. And then we're going to be done. OK, so let's proceed further. So here's what we have here. What we have to compute to evaluate this cross-section are two things. The first thing we want to do is identify which frame we're going to work in. We're going to work in the lab frame where our initial proton is at rest. So I'm imagining I have this electron beam. It comes in and hits a target of made out of protons, hydrogen target, let's say. OK. So then this factor of the relative velocity would just be equal to 1, since the electron is relativistic. And we're assuming that we're working at very high energies. So for example, the incoming and outgoing electron energy, and also the momentum transfer, are much, much larger than the proton mass. So the center of mass energy, S, which is P plus L squared, which is MP squared plus 2 MPEL, is we can just throw away this term compared to this term. OK. So next what we'll do is we want to evaluate. We know what frame we're working in. We want to be able to evaluate this integral. And so I need to actually contract these two tensors together and expand them and express them in terms of my kinematic variables. So I want to compute L mu nu, W mu nu. So this will be the lepton part will look like this. L mu, L prime nu, plus L nu, L prime mu, minus eta mu nu, L dotted into L prime. And then this is all multiplying W1, eta mu nu, plus W2, P mu, P nu over MP squared. So you can go through the algebra of expanding all this stuff, but I'll skip through it a little bit. And so it's not so difficult to do. Basically, what I need to do is plug in the lepton momenta in this particular frame. So I need to use the fact that L mu, let's say, is going in the z direction. And then L prime mu is also relativistic, but it has a particular scattering angle. And so I can write it as, you know, sine theta E L prime 0 cosine theta E L prime. And so theta is a scattering angle. All right, so then it's straightforward to expand all of these terms and then evaluate them in terms of kinematic variables. Here's what we get. We get an overall factor of 2 EL EL prime. And then I have 2 times W1 times 1 minus cosine theta. And then I have plus W2 times 1 plus cosine theta. OK, now the reason I wrote it out like this is because you might wonder, if my cross-section, a function, depends on two unknown functions, how can I measure independently those two functions? And because those two functions are, you know, multiplied factors that depend differently on the angle, I can look in a kinematic regime in which one of those angular terms is large and the other one is small. So if I look at the case where theta is small, then the W1 term is dominant. I mixed this up. When theta is small, cosine theta is 1, and so this term will go to 0. So if theta is large, the W1 term dominates, and when theta is small, W2 term dominates. So in practice, this is how you can have sensitivity experimentally to the two different terms, even though they're embedded within one function. Okay, so we're not going to stop here. We want to keep going and express this object in terms of the kinematic variables that we have defined. And what you can show is that this is given by 4 times the proton mass EL times Y times X times W1 plus 4 EL squared times 1 minus Y W2. OK, so I skipped a bunch of algebra steps. Is that all right? Is it OK? I can go through it if you want, but it's just algebra. OK. So you can see again here how you can distinguish W1 and W2 from each other. Y, remember, is the fractional momentum transfer. And so when the momentum transfer is large, Y goes to 1. And so that's dominated by this term. A large momentum transfer is a large angle scattering. When the momentum transfer is really small, Y goes to 0, which is the same as having a small scattering angle. You're dominated by this term. And so that's how you pick out W2 experimentally. OK. So we have this. And now we want to put it into our cross section and integrate. So I want to do this integral, d3 L prime over 2 pi cubed. I have a 1 over 2 EL prime. So the whole thing is azimuthally symmetric. I can integrate over phi to get a factor of 2 pi. And I'm just left with a 1 over 2 pi squared. I have an integral of EL prime DEL prime, and then D cosine theta. And then I still have another factor of 2. All right, so I have these two integrals to do. I'm just going to do a change of variables to express this not as an integral over energy and scattering angle, but it's going to be now an integral over two of our kinematic variables, x and y. So this whole thing here, you can show using a change of variables is an integral of dx dy times mp times nu. So just using our definitions, you can show that this is true. And again, I'm going to just skip the steps to prove it. All right, so if I plug this in, then I have, it looks like I have a 1 over 8 pi squared. And then I have a factor of mp. And then I have an integral dx, dy, and then nu. Nu is not a constant. Nu, of course, depends on y. It's proportional to y. OK, so now I can write down the differential cross-section here. The full cross-section. So I have 1 over, looks like this. Yeah, I'm basically just going to plug all of this and this into the expression that I have here. Cross off a few terms. Here's what you get. So I have this integral over dx and dy. I have e to the fourth. E I can rewrite using the fine structure constant alpha. So e squared is just 4 pi times alpha. And so I'm left over with a factor of 2 pi times alpha squared. I had 1 over little q to the fourth. That's the same thing as big Q to the fourth. And then I have these factors s times x times y squared times a factor of 2 times mp times w1 plus 2 times s times 1 minus y times a factor of nu times w2. OK, so I'm skipping a few steps, but it's just algebra, plugging in, crossing off terms, and simplifying it. All right, so this is why we define those alternative functions here, because you can see that's exactly what comes up. So this was f1e, and this is f2e here. Now what we'll do is we'll write down the differential cross-section. So we have d squared sigma by dx dy. And that's 2 pi alpha squared over q to the fourth. And then I have f1e, it's a function of x and q squared, times xy squared, plus 2 times f2e of x and q squared times 1 minus y. Okay, so this is as simple as we can make it. We have our cross-section for inelastic scattering, but it depends on these two unknown functions. So it depends on unknown functions. F1 and 2e, which are functions of two kinematic variables. X and q squared. OK, so based on what we've done so far, the best you can hope to do is just measure those experimentally. And that would be it. All right. So that is the end of the first method for calculating this cross-section. Any questions on what we've done so far? Should there be? I think that is correct, yes. Yeah. Okay, did I mess up anything else? Perhaps.
Experimentally, you measure the cross-section, right? Not the differential cross-section.
You can measure the differential cross-section. You're right in a sense that at the end of the day, you're just measuring a rate. But you can access the differential cross-section by restricting your measurement to particular kinematic ranges. So if I'm only sensitive to a cross-section, you know, within a given small range of x, in a given small range of y, that's effectively measuring the differential cross-section. All right. The next step that we're going to do is we're going to come back to this idea we introduced in the beginning of the week, this idea of factorization and the fact that protons and all hadrons are made out of quarks. So we're going to repeat the calculation using these ideas. So how does the idea of factorization enter into this calculation? Well, remember, factorization tells us that the dynamics that's happening at short distances is not affected by what's happening at large distances. This idea that different physical scales separate from one another. So if I want to compute this cross-section, to a given final state h, and I want to think about it in terms of quarks, I can write it down as a factorized product of different terms. So first, I need to know what's the probability of finding a given quark q here with momentum p. So this is the probability of finding a quark q in the proton with momentum p. Then what I want to do is calculate the cross-section for an electron to scatter off of that quark in the proton. So that will be a cross-section for electron quark scattering. And this isn't just an elastic process. The interaction between these two fermions is purely elastic. So this is the cross-section. For scattering off a quark. with momentum P. And to differentiate the hadron level cross sections from the quark level cross sections, people denote this type of cross section with a hat. So without a hat means it's the cross section for scattering off of the proton itself. This is a cross section for scattering off of one of the constituents of the proton. Okay? And then what we have is we've scattered, we have some quark coming out with a different momentum than it started with. And so we need to figure out what the probability is for hadronizing into a given final state H. All right. So the physics here, the probability of finding a quark within a given momentum as it bounces around the proton is set by the large distance scales, scales of order a Fermi. At high energies, we're assuming that our electron is coming in at very high energies. It transfers a lot of energy. The effective wavelength of our photon probe of the proton is much smaller than a Fermi. So this is a small scale set by the Compton wavelength of the photon, much, much smaller than a Fermi. And here, the quark scatters, but then it only notices hadronization, or it only notices a strong interaction once it travels another Fermi, once it tries to escape. And so this is also large distance physics. So this is the idea of factorization. Normally, if you want to compute the rate of a process, you should write down the amplitude of all of these three things, multiply the amplitudes together, and then square all of that. So you'll have all of these cross terms. But factorization tells me that I can neglect the cross terms and just multiply the rates for each of the three things. OK. Then the last step that I have to do is I have to sum over effectively all possible intermediate states. I don't know which quark I hit in the proton. There are many quarks in the proton. I also don't know what momentum that quark had when I hit it. And so I need to sum over all possible quarks, and I need to sum over all of the momenta that they have, or integrate over the momenta that they have. OK. So this is the basic setup. Now, again, we don't know things here. This is going to be the object we're going to calculate, just as a QED scattering process. But we don't know what the probability is for finding quarks of a given momentum in the proton. So that's going to be something that we'll parameterize our ignorance for. We also don't know the probability that a given final state, once the scattering occurs, will hadronize into a particular final state. Okay, so what I wrote here is an exclusive cross section, because it's only for one particular final state H. What we wanted is the inclusive cross section. So we wanted a sum over all of the final states. So now we should sum over, we'll write down what we have here. So we'll sum over Q and P. We have the probability. We have this cross section. And then we have the probability for hadronization. Now you can see that nothing here for these first two terms depends on the hadronic final state. That's only the last term here. So this sum is only really a sum on the last term. So. Now, this object here is the probability that we'll hadronize into a given final state H, but then summed over all possible hadronic final states. And if we assume that quarks confine, we're guaranteed that no matter what final state we have in terms of the quarks, it's guaranteed to hadronize into something. So the total probability that it will hadronize into anything is just 1. And so now this is the object that we want to compute, the product of these two terms. Okay, so this general setup that we've described so far is known as the Parton model. Historically, the Parton model, it was introduced by Feynman, it predates QCD. But it's consistent with QCD, and it's also the modern way in which we calculate these particular processes. So it predates QCD, but it's consistent with the modern version of QCD. So it just says that partons are the constituents of hadrons. Feynman didn't know what those were, but now we do. Those are quarks and gluons. Here, we're considering electromagnetic scattering through the photon. And so we don't need to scatter off of gluons, which carry no electric charge. We only should scatter off of the quarks. OK. And we have a distinction here. We're going to be computing this so-called Parton level cross-section. And we're going to calculate other quantities at the Parton level, different kinematic quantities. And we're going to use hats to distinguish the kinematic quantities, or the various quantities, for partons versus ones at the hadron level that we introduced during the first half of this calculation, where we were talking about the scattering on the proton. So hats denote parton level quantities. So for example, sigma hat. OK. All right, so we have this Parton model. We're going to calculate this cross-section. There's two ingredients. This one, of course, depends on the long-distance physics, the large-distance physics. This we can't calculate directly because it depends on the non-perturbative dynamics of the strong interaction. But this one is short-distance physics, and we can compute it using perturbation theory. So that's what we're going to do. So it depends on the short distance physics. So we're free to use perturbation theory. What order in perturbation theory are we talking about? Well, we're worrying about perturbation theory applying or being valid for the strong interaction. So the leading order in the strong interaction here, if perturbation theory is valid, is just zeroth order in the strong interaction. And so at this level, we can just compute an electromagnetic scattering interaction. And we're not going to worry about any corrections due to the strong interaction. So for example, so I should say this is zeroth order in alpha s. OK. So we're going to compute the electromagnetic scattering process like this. So this is momentum L. This is L prime. This will be momentum little p and little p prime. For the hadron, for the initial momentum of the proton, I used a big P. I tried to make it big. For the momentum of the quarks, I want to use a little p here. The other thing I want to do is I'm just going to assume that the quarks are massless. So this is fine. The mass of the quarks in the proton, well, the up and down quarks at least are very light compared to the masses of the energy that I'm considering. All right, so it's straightforward to calculate a cross section for this process. This is just scattering in QED. So I can write down the matrix element. I have part from the lepton current. I have the photon propagator. And I have a part from the quark current. Here, the electron has an electric charge E, or I should say minus E. And then relative to that, I have to introduce this factor Q, because the quarks don't have the same charge as the electron. OK, so it's also straightforward to sum the square of this matrix element. So this will be 1/4 e to the fourth over q to the fourth. Then I have the quark charge squared, the trace of L prime slash gamma mu, L slash gamma nu, and then the trace of P prime slash gamma mu, P slash gamma nu. All right, it's easy to take these traces and multiply things together. This whole thing gives me a factor of 16. L dotted into P, L prime dotted into P prime, plus L dotted into P prime, L prime dotted into P. OK, so now I can do that. All right, next, I'm going to write down Mandelstam variables. These are going to be for the parton level quantities. So I'll define s hat, t hat, and u hat. And these are just the usual things. The masses are zero for all of these fermions, by assumption. So S hat plus U hat plus T hat plus U hat is equal to zero. And also, I can expand out these squares. When I have a momentum like L squared, for example, it will also give me zero. So I'm just left with 2 L dot P and 2 L prime dot P prime. This one here is just the momentum transfer. So this is q squared. And this one here is minus 2 L dot P prime, or minus 2 L prime dotted into P. OK? So I can rewrite my matrix element squared in terms of these Mandelstam variables. To the fourth q squared over t hat squared. And then I have s hat squared plus u hat squared. OK. Next, we want to compute the cross-section, parton level cross-section. And we'll work in the center mass frame. All right, so I have this phase space integral. Okay, 2 pi fourth delta 4 L plus P minus L prime minus P prime. And then times a quarter sum over the matrix element squared. OK. So I think probably you all have computed cross sections like this before, right? Is that true? So it's really just a two-body phase space integral. I think it's probably familiar. So I'm just going to skip over the steps again, just because there's nothing really deep in the manipulations that follow. Is that all right? OK. OK, so what we get at the end of the day is there's a, one over um, 32 pi s hat. And then the integral we're left over with, we can think of as an integral over cosine theta. And then we have this factor of a quarter times the matrix element squared. OK, so I did all of the integrals that I can do. This one you can do using the delta 3 parts of the delta function. And then we still have three more integrals to do We do one of them because the whole thing is azimuthally symmetric. We just get a factor of 2 pi when we do the phi integral. The energy integral over L we do with the last energy conserving part of the delta function. And then we're just left over with one integral that we can't do, which is the cosine theta integral. And the reason we can't do it is just because this function depends on cosine theta through t and u. All right, so that's as far as we get. But I can write down a differential cross-section, d sigma d cos theta. And this is pi times alpha squared q squared over s hat t hat squared times s hat squared plus u hat squared, like this. OK, so here is our differential cross-section. Now what I'll do is I'm going to change it to be a differential cross-section with respect to t hat instead of cosine theta. So I need to tell you how cosine theta and t hat are related to each other. So let's recall so t hat is L minus L prime squared, and this is minus 2 L dot L prime. And so this is minus 2 EL EL prime, 1 minus cosine theta. So I can figure out what the Jacobian is. It's just 2 times EL EL prime d cosine theta. OK, so now I can write down the differential cross-section versus t hat. This is just 2 pi alpha squared q squared over s hat squared t hat squared times s hat squared plus u hat squared. And this quantity here, 2 times E EL prime is just 1 half S hat. So that's how I get this additional factor of S hat in the denominator. OK, so we have our parton-level cross-section. Now what we want to do is ask, how are the parton-level cross or quantities related to the hadron-level quantities? So we'll go from parton level to hadron level. So the momentum of the photon is the same in the two cases. So q squared is equal to t hat is still minus q squared. So it's the same both at both ways of looking at it. But the momenta of the quark is not the same thing as the momentum of the proton. The quark, one quark doesn't carry all of the momentum of the proton. So what we defined is p, little p, this is the momentum. For momentum of the initial quark. And big P is the four momentum of the initial proton. And so what we want to do is we're going to say that we're going to allow the quark to carry a given fraction of the initial momentum of the proton. So we're going to say that the struck quark, the struck quark is the one that actually participates in this scattering cross-section that we computed. It's the one that gets hit by the photon, effectively. It carries a given fraction of the total momentum. Which I'll call x. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that this little p here is equal to x times big P. These are supposed to be four momenta. And a fraction is just a number between 0 and 1. So this quantity x will be somewhere between 0 and 1. OK. I'll just write over here. So let's solve for x. So we're taking mq, the mass of the quark, to be 0. And so that tells me that little p squared is equal to little p prime squared is equal to 0. So I have little p prime squared. So this is the momentum squared of the final state quark. This is 0. And by momentum conservation, this is p plus l, little p, plus l prime squared. And so this is little p dotted into q plus q squared. This whole thing is q, remember. OK. So now I'm going to use the fact that this little momentum little p is x times big P. So this is x times the proton momentum q, p dotted into q plus q squared. And this whole thing is equal to 0. I can now solve for x. It is minus q squared over 2p dot q. OK, so you might have been worried, why am I introducing another x? It's actually the same x that I introduced before. This is the same Bjorkane x. So we mentioned one interpretation of x. It measures, in a sense, how inelastic the scattering is. When x goes to 1, we have elastic scattering. But here's another interpretation of x. It measures how much of the original proton momentum was carried by the quark that got hit by the photon probe. OK. Then the last thing we need to do is we need to relate S hat, so this is the center mass energy squared for the parton level. To S, which is the center mass energy. At the hadron level. OK, so this is easy to do. We had s hat is p plus l squared. And in the limit where everything is relativistic and massless, this is just 2 times p dot l. And now this is 2 times x times big P dotted into l. Now, we were assuming that we're so relativistic that even the proton mass could be neglected here. And so the total center of mass energy is just 2 times big P dotted into L. So this is just x times S.
Okay. Then I, the last identification that I need to make, I just need two more things. So we had y was p dot q over p dot l. I can rewrite this using x. So this is x times little p dot q over x times little p dot l. The x's will cancel. And what I have in this quantity here is minus t hat over s hat. And then there's a factor of 2 on the top and the bottom, which cancel out. So this tells me that t hat is just minus x times y times s. And then lastly, u hat is minus s hat minus t hat is equal to minus s times x, 1 minus y. Okay. All right, so we're out of time. We're almost done with the calculation. We just need to plug in. So we have our differential cross section up here. And the only thing we're going to do is just express it in terms of our set of kinematic variables that we had introduced during the first calculation. Okay, that is all.